Ainsley. They are going to Martha's Vineyard. Billy is dead. Billy is the only grandfather Ainsley has ever known because her father's father, Wyatt Sr., died before Ainsley was born. Ainsley, Tabitha, and Ainsley's grandmother, Eleanor, take the fast ferry from Nantucket to Oak Bluffs. While standing in line, Ainsley accidentally refers to it as Oak's Bluff, and she is reprimanded by a woman even older than Grammy who was standing behind her. This woman puts a hand on Ainsley's shoulder and says, "One tree, many bluffs." Or more likely, "One kind of tree, many bluffs." "Whatever," Ainsley says. Eleanor pipes up, "One needs to know." Ainsley nearly rolls her eyes in her mother's direction until she remembers that she hates her mother. Tabitha intentionally destroyed Ainsley's phone, and thus Ainsley has no way to get hold of anyone, not Emma, not Teddy. Her mother kept her in the house all weekend, even though it was beautiful weather. Her mother didn't go to yoga class and, even more shocking, didn't go to check on things at the boutique. Ainsley had said, "You can go into the store for a few hours, Tabitha." "I'm not going to go anywhere." This was a barefaced lie. As soon as Tabitha pulled out of the driveway, Ainsley intended to ride her bike to Teddy's. Tabitha said, "Grammy is going in for me." "Grammy?" Ainsley said. Eleanor is a designer. She is an artist and a genius, but she has not, to Ainsley's knowledge, ever gone into the boutique to manage or supervise. That has always been Tabitha's job. "Yes," Tabitha said. She had given Ainsley her fakest smile. "I'm staying here with you." Spending 2 days shut up in the house without a phone had been a living hell. Because Billy had died, Tabitha spent most of the time mooning around. She pulled out old photo albums. All photo albums were old, Ainsley knew, but these were really old, displaying pictures of her mother and Aunt Harper when they were babies. Tabitha had encouraged Ainsley to join her on the sofa, which smelled like marijuana smoke and probably would forever, a fact that secretly pleased Ainsley. Tabitha had said, "You should see these. These are pictures from when we were a whole family. Your grandparents are married, and Harper and I are wearing matching outfits." Ainsley did not deign to respond. Her mother could ground her, and her mother could drown her phone, but her mother could not make her speak. Ainsley spent the majority of her time in lockdown worrying. Ainsley and Teddy had planned on going to dinner at the Jetties, where, it was rumored, G-Love was going to play a surprise set. They had heard this from Teddy's Uncle Graham, who would be shucking oysters and clams at the Raw Bar. With Ainsley grounded, Teddy might offer to take Emma to the Jetties instead. As Ainsley lay in bed watching reruns of Chopped on TV, Emma and Teddy might be drunk and swaying together in the crush of people energized by G-Love's magical appearance. They might kiss. Emma is a thrill seeker without morals. She would think nothing of stealing Ainsley's boyfriend. Ainsley wants to hate Emma, but she can't. So Ainsley hates Tabitha. Tabitha had started drinking wine at 5 o'clock. The expensive Nicholas J. Pinot Noir from the Willamette Valley in Oregon that she used to drink before Ramsey put her on rosé. Tabitha had then asked Ainsley if she wanted a glass. Ainsley had thrown her mother a look of contempt. What mixed messages she was sending. The whole reason Ainsley was under house arrest was because she had been drinking and smoking weed and turning the living room into a frat house. And what does Tabitha do? Offer Ainsley a glass of wine. Ainsley was so agitated about the Emma-Teddy scenario forming in her mind that she could have used a drink. But 3 years earlier, when Ainsley was first experimenting with alcohol, she had consumed a bottle and a half of the Nicholas J. Pinot Noir. It was delicious, she'd thought initially, like a rich, plummy juice. But shortly afterward, she'd started puking purple. She would never drink red wine again. Tabitha passed out by 9, and Ainsley would have sneaked out at that point, except that Eleanor had been alerted to her granddaughter's escapades, and an alarm had been activated that would sound if anyone broke the threshold of the driveway in either direction. There would be no coming or going that night. Ainsley had ended up paging through the photo albums by herself, and she had to admit it was fascinating. There were clippings of Billy and Eleanor on the society pages of the Boston Globe. In every photo, Billy leaned in to kiss Eleanor's cheek while she gave the camera a brilliant smile. They looked pretty much in love to Ainsley. There was another photo in the album that showed Eleanor, enormously pregnant, the size of a hippo, really, draped in a yellow dress that might also have been a pup tent. Billy wore square, wire-framed glasses and white bell-bottoms and a white patent leather belt, and he held up two fingers over Eleanor's shoulder. So, this was the day they found out they were having twins. The dates were stamped onto all the photos, and this one said, October 10, 1977. Ainsley felt like she knew that Grammy didn't discover she was having twins until very late in the pregnancy, and now she sees it was only 6 or 8 weeks before the twins were born. This is what baffles Ainsley about the olden days, before technology. People didn't know anything. There were no ultrasounds to tell Grammy she was having two babies instead of one. There was no internet. How did anyone know anything without the internet? Really, Ainsley can't figure that one out. And there were no cell phones. How did a person live without a cell phone? Ainsley was doing it right now, and it was very stressful. She might have logged onto her laptop and checked Facebook or Instagram to see if Emma had posted anything about going to the jetties with Teddy, but Tabitha had changed the Wi-Fi password, just as she'd promised. Most of the rest of the pictures were of her mother and Aunt Harper. They looked exactly alike. There was no possibility of telling them apart, and Ainsley wondered if when they were babies, their identities had been switched, then switched again, maybe switched infinite times, until the day they were old enough to speak and say their names out loud. Then whoever they happened to be that day stuck. Eleanor always dressed them in matching outfits that she made herself, using her turquoise Singer sewing machine, which she still had, and always claimed she was going to donate to the Smithsonian. There were green gingham jumpers with giraffes appliqued on the front. There were pretty pink party dresses with borders of purple sequins at the bottom. There were black velvet dresses at Christmas. Who put 2-year-olds in black? Ainsley wondered. Only Eleanor. It was well documented that Eleanor Roxy Frost got her big break in fashion when Diana Vreeland happened across the twins wearing yellow linen shifts during a playground outing on Boston Common in 1980. Those dresses were miniature versions of what would become the Roxy. It had been in the era of women's lib, and Eleanor Roxy Frost became a textbook case. She went from being a stay-at-home mother of twins, designing clothes for her daughters and herself, to a fashion design sensation featured in Vogue nearly every month. When the twins were in high school, Eleanor found retail space on Newbury Street and opened her flagship store there. The store had been a good thing and a bad thing, because Eleanor became so busy being a famous fashion designer that something in her life had to go. That something was Billy. Ainsley's grandparents got divorced, a fact that Ainsley always found embarrassing. Around half of her friends' parents were divorced, but grandparents were meant to stay together until they keeled over from being so old. Even stranger and more unsettling was that, after the divorce, Aunt Harper had gone with Billy, and Tabitha had stayed with Eleanor, a custody agreement that seemed to have been borrowed from the parent trap. The Frost family had split right down the middle, like one of these photographs torn in half, Billy holding one twin, Eleanor the other. When Ainsley had gone to replace the photo album, she came across a tattered envelope wedged between two other books on the shelf. The envelope had an important secret look, so Ainsley pulled it free. Inside was a plastic hospital bracelet bearing the inscription, Julian Wyatt Cruz, 5-28-03. It was her baby brother's bracelet. Also in the envelope were 3 snapshots, one of a teensy tiny Julian at the hospital enclosed in what looked like a plastic display case with tubes and wires running from his mouth, nose, chest, and feet. The second was a photograph of Tabitha holding Julian in two hands. Really, he was no bigger than a submarine sandwich. He had only weighed 1 pound and 10 ounces when he was born, she knew. The third photo was of Tabitha, Wyatt, Ainsley, and Julian, all together in a house Ainsley didn't recognize, although they were sitting on the dark brown leather sofa that had predated the turquoise tweed Girvan. Julian was free of wires, and he was a little bigger, maybe the size of a bag of flour. Ainsley was a pudgy-faced toddler with barely enough hair to make pigtails. But the real shocker was how young Ainsley's parents looked. There were seniors at Nantucket High School who looked older than Tabitha and Wyatt did in that picture. Both of them were smiling, laughing even, as though the photographer had just said something funny. Who took the picture? Ainsley wondered. Not Eleanor, certainly. She didn't believe in joking around. Ainsley scrutinized the photo for another moment. It was the only photograph of her nuclear family that she had ever seen. She knew why it was hidden away. Tabitha found the loss of Julian, and maybe the loss of Wyatt, too painful. Ainsley was grateful that Tabitha hadn't kept Julian's death certificate or anything morbid like that. The hospital bracelet was jarring enough. Ainsley returned everything back to the envelope, then the envelope back to its hiding spot between the two books on the shelf. She turned to check on her mother, who was still snoring softly on the sofa. She resisted the urge to kiss her mother's forehead, although she did gently nudge Tabitha awake. "Hey," Ainsley said. "It's time to go to bed now, Mama." And like a dutiful child, Tabitha had risen and followed Ainsley down the stairs. Now it's Monday, and Ainsley should be at school, where she finally might discover what had happened during the remainder of everyone's weekend. Maybe she hasn't been the only one to get punished. Maybe the unthinkable happened and Emma has been grounded as well. Although Ainsley doesn't think so, because it had been Emma's father, Dutch, who provided the weed and the beer for the party. He had actually asked Emma if she wanted any Coke, not the drink, he said, wink, wink. But Emma had used common sense and said, no, thank you. Ainsley had really liked Dutch until she heard that. Now she questions his ethics. To provide beer and weed to your 16-year-old daughter makes you not only a cool parent, but also kind of a criminal. To offer Coke makes you only a criminal. Ainsley wonders if Teddy got into any trouble and decides the answer is also no. Graham is an uncle. The whole parenting thing was thrust at him because his brother died fighting a fire and his sister-in-law, Teddy's mother, is a suicidal, depressed anorexic back in Oklahoma. Graham is only now mastering the basics, food on the table 3 times a day, making sure Teddy gets to school and sports practice on time. He's a star at baseball, which is big in Oklahoma, whereas lacrosse is big in Nantucket. Make sure he's doing his homework. Take him to get his driver's license. Give him chores so he learns responsibility. This summer, Teddy is going to work as a bellhop at the boutique hotel 21 Broad. Teddy is so grateful for Graham's steadying presence in his life that he doesn't like doing anything that might land him in trouble. He did borrow Graham's truck and say he was going on a date with Ainsley, and Graham did hand him $40, which Teddy gave to BC to buy cups and vodka. But Teddy didn't smoke or drink anything. He only came to the party to be with Ainsley. Candace Beasley probably got in trouble. This time last year, Ainsley would never have invited Candace to a party. Candace and Ainsley had been best friends when they were little girls. They had the same teachers, participated in the same activities. In 4th grade, when Tabitha took Ainsley to Los Angeles for spring break, Candace came along. They rode the Ferris wheel on the Santa Monica Pier together. They ordered room service in their suite at Shutters on the Beach while Tabitha went to the bar to conduct business meetings. They went to the spa and got their nails painted the same color. They used to pretend they were sisters. They used to pretend, at Ainsley's insistence, that they were not only sisters, but also twins. But there had been some essential difference between Ainsley and Candace, and it concerned the way they were being raised. Ainsley, because she spent so much time with her mother and grandmother, was always encouraged to act older than she was. She accompanied Tabitha and Eleanor to the galley for lunch and, when they were in Boston, to tea at the Four Seasons. Ainsley had been allowed to stay home by herself during the day, starting when she was 8 years old. She could use the microwave to make popcorn and then melt extra butter. She was allowed to watch Gossip Girl. She had a triple-decker pink aluminum case filled with makeup that Tabitha had bought her. Once, when Candace had been over for the afternoon, on what Candace's mother, Stephanie, still called a playdate, Candace had gone downstairs made up with foundation, powder, blush, eyeliner, eyeshadow, mascara, and lipstick, and Stephanie had screamed as though Candace were missing a limb. She had yanked Candace into the powder room and scrubbed her face right there and then with one of the blue soaps shaped like a scallop shell that nobody ever used. Tabitha had laughed and said, "Don't you think you're overreacting? They're little girls playing dress-up." Stephanie had said, "You can let your daughter walk around looking like a prostitute, but I'm not going to." Tabitha had shrugged the comment off, but it had taken root in Ainsley. She knew Stephanie thought there was something inappropriate about the way Ainsley was being raised. Candace, also an only child, was being raised like a baby. She had 10,000 rules to abide by, 4 bites of everything on her plate, including broccoli and lima beans, PBS Kids and Disney Channel only, no Nickelodeon of any kind, bedtime at 8 o'clock, even on weekends, teeth brushing and flossing, and a schedule of chores that earned Candace $1 a week deposited into her college fund. Ainsley found much in Candace's house to admire. The meals were homemade and delicious. Stephanie and her husband, Stu, said a nice short grace before eating and then kissed each other. The bath towels were fluffy. The sheets on Candace's bed were always crisp and neatly made. And always, Stephanie would read to them before bed. Tabitha, by contrast, watched every morsel that Ainsley put in her mouth, forbidding donuts, pancakes, and baked potatoes. Ainsley had learned the term empty calorie by 3rd grade. Tabitha dressed Ainsley in smaller versions of her grandmother's designs, dresses that would have fetched $500 or more on eBay. She gave Ainsley lessons in how to walk in high heels and how to throw French phrases into everyday conversation. A tout à l'heure. Probably Ainsley's fondest memory of growing up is coming home from school, drinking Coke Zero on the sofa with Tabitha, and paging through the new issue of Vogue with Tabitha covering the captions with her hand and quizzing Ainsley on the designers. Once Ainsley got to middle school, she was able to turn the unorthodox way she'd been raised to her advantage. She was the coolest person in 6th grade, the prettiest, the most developed, and the best dressed by far. Candace had cried on the first day because she got lost changing classes and missed their 5th grade teacher, Mr. Bonaventura. Like countless middle school girls before her, Ainsley secured her position as Queen Bee by stepping on the people below her, and her favorite rung had been Candace. Stephanie had changed her tune over the course of that year. She called Tabitha incessantly, hoping to get the girls together. "I'm not sure what happened," Stephanie said. "I think they had some kind of falling out, but I'm sure it can be fixed, right?" Through middle school and into high school, Candace had sought Ainsley's attention and approval, but to no avail. Ainsley didn't say hello, didn't acknowledge Candace's presence in the hallway, in the cafeteria, in the classroom. Ainsley became friends with Emma Marlowe, and they had their disciples, BC, Maggie, Anna, and Teddy. But just this past spring, something happened with Candace. Her father's online hotel booking business had been bought up by Orbitz, and suddenly the family was very well off. Stephanie and Stu took Candace to Aspen to ski in February and to St. Bart's in April, and, while they were away, Candace had acquired a set of sophisticated habits. She had, apparently, slept with the son of a sheik in Aspen, drunk Dom Perignon at lunch with her parents at a place called Nikki Beach in St. Bart's, and started smoking clove cigarettes. Over the course of a few short months, Candace had become cool. So Ainsley, out of fear of being overthrown more than anything else, had invited Candace to her house for the party. Candace might have exaggerated her vacation exploits because at the party she was the only person other than Teddy able to drive when Tabitha got home. Tabitha had given Candace the keys to Emma's Range Rover. Emma might be angry at Ainsley for that, and no one is more intimidating when angry than Emma. Ainsley has no way of knowing what's going on in her world without her phone. The ferry is nearing land, and Tabitha goes to stand at the window. Ainsley refuses to join her, but she cranes her neck. There's an expansive green park to the left with a white gazebo in the middle. Ainsley touches her grandmother's arm. "Have you ever been to the vineyard?"
"Not since my honeymoon," Eleanor says.
"Your grandfather and I traveled to both Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard on a motor yacht my father chartered for us. I'm sure you can guess that I preferred one island and Billy the other. This was Billy's place." Ainsley processes this. Eleanor and Billy not only split up their possessions, their money, and their twins, they also split up the islands. Nantucket for Eleanor, the vineyard for Billy.
"Has my mother ever been here?" Ainsley asks.
"Oh, certainly," Eleanor says. "Back before..."
"Before what?" Ainsley asks.
"Before everything happened," Eleanor says. "I believe the last time she came to visit Billy here was when she was pregnant."
"With me?" Ainsley says. "Or with Julian?"
"Who can remember?" Eleanor says. She waves a hand laden with rings. Eleanor is 71 years old and the most elegant woman Ainsley knows. She has traveled to Paris and Milan and Shanghai and Bombay and Marrakech and Sydney and Rome and Tokyo. She has boutiques in Nantucket and Palm Beach. The Nantucket store closes in the winter. The Palm Beach store closes in the summer. Eleanor's flagship store, on Newbury Street, shut down for good last year because of declining sales. Ainsley suspects her grandmother's designs are becoming dated. Ainsley is shocked that her mother and grandmother are even attending Billy's memorial reception. It's not a funeral. Billy has been cremated, and his ashes will be kept in an urn. Ainsley saw the photos of Eleanor and Billy together in the album, but for as long as Ainsley can remember, there has been a Hatfield and McCoy-type feud between the two halves of the family. Tabitha hates Harper for reasons Ainsley isn't privy to, and she assumes that Eleanor hated Billy as well. She would ask Eleanor, but she's too intimidated. Tabitha turns to Ainsley.
"Oak Bluffs has this thing called the Methodist Campground," she says. "It's all these different colored gingerbread houses, and in the center is the tabernacle, which is a large outdoor church-type thing."
"It sounds like a cult," Eleanor says.
"Oh, dear God,"
Tabitha says, looking at the people who have amassed on the dock to await the ferry's arrival.
"There she is."
Ainsley sees her mother's double standing in the crowd. The sight is so surreal that Ainsley turns to look at her mother to make sure she is standing right there. Then she looks back in the crowd at Aunt Harper. Aunt Harper wears her hair just as her mother does, long, heavy, and dark. But of course her clothes are different. Tabitha wears the Roxy, the linen shift with the Obi, in black, and a pair of black patent leather Manolo Blahnik pumps that she normally reserves for the city. Aunt Harper is wearing a pair of black pants that looks like something a waitress at a Red Lobster might wear, and some kind of black lace shell that Ainsley, who has developed a pretty sharp eye when it comes to other people's poor fashion choices, suspects came off the sale rack at Banana Republic. The top and pants don't make sense together. The pants utilitarian, the shell dressy, and black lace, according to Eleanor, always references lingerie, which makes it inappropriate for a funeral or memorial reception. Despite Aunt Harper's pitiful outfit, or perhaps because of it, Ainsley's heart is captured. Aunt Harper is the underdog here, the first one Ainsley has found herself rooting for in 16 and a half years. Harper looks very tense as Eleanor, Tabitha, and Ainsley, in that order, step off the ramp.
Hello, Mommy, Harper says.
Eleanor takes an appraising look at her daughter.
Hello, darling, Eleanor says.
She leans forward to air kiss Harper's cheek. Then she takes the lace material of Harper's top between her fingers.
Where did you get this?
I don't know, Harper says.
At the store?
I'm roasting in it. When she plucks the top away from her body, Ainsley notices that her aunt is wearing her grandfather's gold watch. Evidently so does Eleanor, because she says,
I can't believe your father managed to keep that watch out of Hawk.
He left it to you?
He did,
Harper says.
Be certain to follow his example and hold on to it no matter what circumstances you find yourself in,
Eleanor says.
That watch is valuable. It belonged to his father, Dr. Richard Frost.
It was Billy's prized possession.
I realize this, Mommy,
Harper says. I'm saving it for when Ainsley has a son. She looks past Tabitha to Ainsley.
Hello, Ainsley.
Ainsley hasn't seen her aunt in 3 years. Somehow, Ainsley had been allowed to go with Billy to Fenway, and Aunt Harper had been there. 4 years before that, when Ainsley was 9, she had gone to the Cape with Billy, and they met Harper for lunch in Woods Hole. So this is only the 3rd time Harper can remember seeing her aunt. Yet Ainsley feels comfortable rushing into her aunt's arms and, inexplicably, starting to cry.
I loved Gramps, she says.
He loved you, Harper says. She gives Ainsley a hug that feels more maternal than any hug she has ever received from Tabitha. When Ainsley pulls away, she watches her mother and aunt face each other. The moment is so awkward, so awful, that Ainsley's insides twist. Hug each other, she thinks. Her mother hates Harper, but is the opposite true?
Tabitha,
Harper says.
Harper, Tabitha says.
They do not move toward each other, and in fact, it feels like the air between them is thrumming with bad energy. It's like they're two magnets with the same poles, repelling each other.
All right, then,
Eleanor says, clearly already weary of the reunion.
Shall we go?
Ainsley is delighted to see that Aunt Harper drives a vintage navy blue Bronco that has been impeccably restored. Since Ainsley has been dating Teddy, she has logged in a lot of hours watching Barrett Jackson live.
Is this a 68?
Ainsley asks.
It is,
Harper says.
Good eye.
I thought you were hiring a car, Eleanor says. Martha's Vineyard executive transport was booked, Harper says.
I assure you, I did call them.
I'm sorry, Mommy, but you'll have to slum it.
Sit up front, Mother, Tabitha says. Ainsley and I will squeeze in the back.
Ainsley doesn't want to squeeze in anywhere with Tabitha, but she obliges because her grandmother is a senior citizen and belongs up front. The back of the car is basically a dumpster for coffee cups, old issues of the Vineyard Gazette, greasy paper bags that look and smell like they might contain half of a week-old tuna fish sandwich, chew toys, and empty airline-sized bottles of Jägermeister. Tabitha tries to wrap up all the junk in a sheet of newspaper just so she can find a place to put her feet in their $800 shoes. The back seat has a sheet over it, but the floor is covered with dog hair.
Do you have a dog?
Ainsley says. She has been asking Tabitha for a dog ever since she could talk.
Fish,
Harper says.
You have a fish?
Ainsley says.
A dog named Fish,
Harper says. He's a Siberian husky.
That's certainly an odd name,
Eleanor says.
It sounds like something your father would dream up. You always were exactly like Billy.
I'd love to give you a tour of the island, Harper says.
I want a tour,
Ainsley says. She had sort of been dreading this day, but already the payoff has been tremendous. Her mother's and grandmother's obvious misery has cheered Ainsley up.
But we really don't have time, Harper says. The reception starts at noon, and your ferry back is at...
Not soon enough, Tabitha murmurs.
4 o'clock,
Eleanor says.
But I feel we should return to the dock no later than 3:15, don't you, Pony?
If not earlier, Tabitha says. Harper snorts. She still calls you Pony?
Who is she? Eleanor asks. The cat's mother?
Harper catches Ainsley's eye in the rearview mirror. You know the story behind that nickname, right?
Please don't,
Tabitha says. Mom wanted a pony, Ainsley says. Your mother not only wanted a pony, your mother also became a pony, Harper says, for most of third grade. Ponytail, brown Shetland sweater, brown corduroys. She neighed and whinnied. She trotted, cantered, and galloped. She did everything shy of eating hay. The way people were able to tell us apart that year was that your mother acted like a horse and I didn't.
I remember it differently, Tabitha says.
We must leave the reception at 3 o'clock sharp, Eleanor says. You needn't worry about driving us. I'll happily pay for a taxi. Ainsley looks out the window, trying to take it all in. There's a pond, a bridge, a field. It looks like Nantucket, but it's not Nantucket. 6 towns, Harper is saying. 17,000 year-round residents. The greatest ice cream in the world at Mad Martha's. You've never tasted the ice cream at the juice bar, Ainsley says. Or have you? Have you ever been to Nantucket, Aunt Harper?
I have, Harper says, but not in a long, long time.
Who's going to be at this reception? Tabitha asks.
I'm not sure, Harper says. Daddy wanted this, not me. But an announcement went up on Islanders Talk and my Facebook page, so...
So mostly Billy's friends or mostly your friends? Tabitha asks.
Daddy's.
Do you have any friends? Tabitha asks.
Mama, Ainsley says, forgetting that she's not speaking to Tabitha.
I have friends, Harper says. I'm not talking about the men you're screwing, Tabitha says.
Tabitha, Ainsley says, more to get her mother's attention than to be disrespectful.
I'm surprised anyone talks to you after that drug bust, Eleanor says. I still can't get over a daughter of mine. Arrested.
Your grandparents are rolling over in their graves, I assure you.
What do you know about it, Mommy? Harper says. Honestly, what do you know about it?
Anne Lane told me everything, Eleanor says.
You do realize she lives right next door to the family whose child you corrupted, don't you? She says the state police were there and the FBI.
The FBI? Ainsley thinks. Her aunt is way more interesting than Ainsley realized.
I didn't corrupt any child, Harper says.
The child in question was already plenty corrupted when I encountered him. Anne Lane can stick a Pop-Tart up her ass, and I can assure you she will not be at this reception, unless you invited her.
Did you invite her?
No,
Eleanor says.
Who is Anne Lane? Ainsley asks.
A busybody, Harper says.
My roommate, Eleanor says, from Pine Manor.
There is a loaded silence, during which Harper's driving becomes markedly more aggressive. She honks her horn and flips people off. By way of explanation, she says, it's so early in the season that the taxi drivers don't know where they're going. There are accidents waiting to happen.
So, Tabitha says, leaning forward, are you seeing anyone?
You haven't said boo to me in 14 years, Harper says, and now you want me to answer personal questions?
She puts on her turn signal and makes a left down a long driveway bordered on both sides by white fencing. The sign says, Farm Neck Golf Club, private.
We're here, Harper says.
She seeks Ainsley's eyes out in the mirror again. This was your grandfather's favorite place on the island, Farm Neck.
This is private? Eleanor asks.
Yes, Mommy.
How did your father manage to get in?
He knew people. Unfortunately, you can't pass the membership on. This died with Billy, but we get to use it one last time.
I didn't even know Gramps golfed, Ainsley says.
He was an abominable golfer, Eleanor says. He downright embarrassed himself at the country club with my father in 1968. The summer we were married.
He was a better drinker than a golfer, Harper says. I'll agree with you there.
made him popular in a foursome. Everyone could beat him, and he told good stories at the clubhouse.
Please don't glorify alcohol consumption in front of my daughter, Tabitha says.
Ainsley rolls her eyes. Harper parks the Bronco, then hurries around to help Eleanor out. When they are all standing in the parking lot, Harper holds her arms akimbo. She looks off balance, like she might topple over.
Welcome to Farm Neck, Harper says.
The grounds of the club are pretty. There's a line of golf carts, some with bags of clubs in the back, and there's a putting green by the front entrance. The air smells like cut grass and French fries. Ainsley marvels that Billy managed to belong to a private club when she knows that both Eleanor and Tabitha have been languishing on the list at the Nantucket Yacht Club for nearly a decade.
Obama played here, Harper says, and Clinton.
I wouldn't advertise that, Eleanor says. The reception is being held in a tent off the side of the clubhouse, and although it's a much smaller affair than Ainsley anticipated, it's still very nice. The tent is decorated with white lanterns and potted plants. There are high-top tables scattered throughout, and a waitress holds a tray of champagne flutes filled to the brim, greeting people as they walk in. There's an easel holding a picture of Ainsley's grandfather in his later years after he'd lost his wire-rimmed glasses and his white patent leather belt. In this photo, he's on a boat. He wears a visor. His face is tan and weather-beaten, and he's holding up a striped bass. Above the photograph, it says, Remembering William O'Shaughnessy Frost, April 13, 1944, to June 16, 2017. There's a table beneath the easel on which rest blank name tags and a Sharpie marker.
Are we doing name tags? Ainsley asks her mother.
Heavens no, Tabitha says. She lifts a flute of champagne off the tray.
Hello, gorgeous.
The waitress seems to think Tabitha is speaking to her instead of to the champagne.
Harper? She says. I don't think I've ever seen you wear heels before.
I'm not Harper, Tabitha says. I'm her twin sister, Tabitha.
Seriously? The waitress says.
Ainsley picks up a name tag and writes, Billy's granddaughter. But she doesn't leave enough room for granddaughter, so she has to crumple it up and start over. She affixes the name tag to the front of her black Millie butterfly sleeve dress. The tent is hot. She's going to melt. She wishes she'd worn something more summery, but Tabitha and Eleanor had insisted on black. They are the only people who dressed up. Everyone else is in regular daytime clothes. There is a group of men in golf shirts, a couple of middle-aged women in slacks and comfortable shoes, and a frosted blonde woman of a certain age wearing a Lily Pulitzer sundress and sandals. Harper is over in the far corner of the tent talking to a policeman, and for a second Ainsley wonders if her aunt is in trouble. But then Ainsley sees tender gestures. First, the officer touches Harper's cheek, then the two of them start kissing. If Eleanor sees them, she'll have a conniption fit. She deplores public displays of affection, and although Eleanor isn't blatantly racist, she is old-fashioned. She calls black people Negroes, no matter how many times both Ainsley and Tabitha have informed her that the term is not acceptable. Will Eleanor care that Harper is kissing a black policeman in front of the assembled guests? Was that the reason Harper deflected Tabitha's question about whether she was seeing anyone? Eleanor and Tabitha are busy signing the guest book, each with a glass of champagne in hand, and they don't notice Harper and the policeman going gangbusters in the corner. Ainsley misses Teddy. She feels a dull pain, like her heart has a cramp, when she thinks about Teddy with Emma. Finally, Harper pulls away. The policeman strolls out of the tent past Ainsley, close enough for her to hear the static of his walkie-talkie and smell his aftershave. He's cute. He's young. Possibly closer to Ainsley's age than her aunt's. Go Aunt Harper, Ainsley thinks. Tabitha broke up with Ramsey, which is another reason Ainsley hates her mother. She brought Ramsey into Ainsley's life, encouraged her to love him. and Ainsley did love Ramsay very much. Then she gave him the boot. Now Tabitha jokes about taking a younger lover. She jokes about the guy who teaches surfing lessons at Cisco Beach and about Mr. Bly, Ainsley's chemistry teacher. Every time Tabitha brings it up, Ainsley thinks, ew. But thinking about her aunt dating a policeman does not inspire the same distaste. Tabitha could never catch or keep a guy that young and hot, Ainsley thinks, despite the fact that she and Harper are identical twins. Tabitha is too stuck up and absolutely no fun. Harper speaks to the gentleman in golf shirts. She says something that makes them laugh. Then she approaches Ainsley. Would you like a glass of champagne? She asks. I ordered the good stuff, Tattinger, and there are supposed to be finger sandwiches and sliders. I kept it waspy for your grandmother's sake. No spring rolls, no quesadillas. Nothing with any actual flavor, Ainsley says. She gives Harper a conspiratorial smile. It's so bizarre, her mother's face on a much nicer, cooler person. So was that guy, the policeman, your boyfriend? Harper's expression changes. She looks anxious, like she's been caught. Boyfriend? She says. You mean Drew? I'm sorry, Ainsley says. It's none of my business. Harper takes a long look at Ainsley, as if she's trying to see inside her somehow. I wish I could go back to your age, she says. Start over. I do things differently. Ainsley nods. I'd love some champagne, she says. And I'll even eat pale triangular sandwiches. I'm starving. We didn't have breakfast. Harper says, just take a flute of champagne, and if anyone gives you trouble, tell them your grandfather wrote it into his will that you're not only allowed to drink champagne at his memorial, you're also supposed to. Ainsley nods, knowing full well that this explanation will not work with her mother or grandmother. I'm going to check on things back in the kitchen, Harper says. Cut some crusts off myself if I have to. Harper leaves the tent, and Ainsley feels abandoned. She sees her grandmother and mother standing off to the side, holding their champagne flutes in front of them as they would hold crosses in the presence of vampires. They aren't speaking to each other or to anyone else. God forbid they actually engage with Billy's friends. Why did they even bother coming? Ainsley grabs a flute of champagne from the waitress's tray and heads over to the men in golf shirts. Hello, she says. I'm Ainsley, Billy's granddaughter. Ainsley drinks that flute of champagne. Then Smitty, the ringleader among Billy's golfing buddies, procures her another. The champagne goes right to her head on an empty stomach, but she doesn't care. She kind of likes it. She is a celebrity here, at least among these men and all the people Smitty introduces her to, such as the woman in the Lily Pulitzer shift, presented to Ainsley, with a nudge and a wink that make Ainsley think she should pay special attention, as Mrs. Tobias. I loved your grandpa, Mrs. Tobias says. He was a dreamboat. Mrs. Tobias is very tan. She's somewhere in her mid-50s, which is too old to pull off the kind of sundress she's wearing. It's best suited for someone Ainsley's age, and her frosted blonde hair is styled like Rachel's from Friends. But she's pretty. She's a heck of a lot younger and sexier and more attractive than Eleanor, although she lacks Eleanor's elegance and grace. Dreamboat, Ainsley thinks. Was this her grandfather's girlfriend? Or maybe just his paramour? What to make of the name Mrs. Tobias? Where, if anywhere, is Mr. Tobias? But before Ainsley can formulate the kind of probing questions that will yield more specifics, her attention is snagged by something happening over by the entrance. The tent has filled up with people, and servers are now passing trays of hors d'oeuvres, shrimp cocktail, radish sandwiches, pigs in a blanket. So it's hard to see. Plus, Ainsley's vision is hazy, thanks to the champagne. But she hears a woman shouting, "Where is she? Where is she?" The voice carries over the polite cocktail party chatter, and soon heads turn and voices are hushed. Ainsley sees a couple enter the tent, the woman petite, with very short hair and bug eyes,
and a man in a suit and tie following her, reaching for her arm, trying to quiet her down.
Who is this?
Ainsley wonders, and at the same time, Mrs. Tobias murmurs,
Oh shit, here it comes.
Here what comes? Ainsley's eyes widen in wonder, then shock, as the bug-eyed woman approaches Tabitha and Eleanor.
You,
she says. The person she seems to be addressing is Tabitha.
What?
Ainsley thinks. She sees Aunt Harper enter the tent just as the bug-eyed woman throws a full flute of champagne all over the front of Tabitha's black Roxy dress, and then, with a whip-quick motion, slaps Tabitha across the face. The sound of the slap reverberates through the tent. The crowd gasps, then goes silent. Harper. She understands the timing is bad. Her father's memorial reception is held only 3 days after Sadie catches her and Reed together in the parking lot of Lucy Vincent. 3 days is long enough for the rumor to spread, but not long enough for people to forget about it and move on. She considered canceling the memorial reception, but Billy had wanted only one thing, and it was a farewell party at Farm Neck. And besides, in a text sent late Sunday night, when Harper was lying face down in bed, determined never to rise again, Reed said that he'd managed to calm Sadie down. He said he'd convinced her that what she saw wasn't Reed and Harper screwing, but rather Reed embracing Harper in an attempt to comfort her after the death of her father. Yes, he understood it seemed odd and possibly unprofessional, meeting a patient's family member at midnight in the parking lot of Lucy Vincent Beach, but that was why they loved the vineyard, right? Because it was a close-knit community where people genuinely cared for one another, and Reed had a long-established history of going above and beyond the call of duty for his patients. Sadie should also remember that she'd had a lot to drink at the barbecue at Lambert's Cove, a lot, and therefore she couldn't trust anything she thought she'd seen. She was lucky she hadn't been pulled over. With these assurances from Reed that Sadie had been neutralized, Harper proceeded with her plan. That Sadie had then, apparently, gone all Nancy Drew on him, checking Reed's phone records and quizzing Dee, Harper's favorite nurse at the hospital, who said that yes, she had been suspicious about an affair all along, came as a surprise to Reed, but not to Harper. Sadie's outburst at the reception had, initially, worked in Harper's favor. It was wildly inappropriate, bursting into a beloved Islander's funeral, dousing his daughter in drink, then striking her. In the seconds after Sadie slapped Tabitha, not Harper, a mistake Harper deeply regretted, Drew had appeared out of nowhere to subdue Mrs. Zimmer. He pried the empty champagne flute from her hand. No one wanted to see any breaking glass, and gently restrained her by holding both wrists. Sadie spat in Tabitha's general direction.
That woman is an evil bitch!
That woman, Drew said, is my girlfriend.
No, Tabitha said, not me, my twin sister.
She offered her hand to Drew.
I'm Tabitha.
Harper had been amazed that Pony had been able to regain her composure so shortly after being slapped. Her cheek was a hot, blazing red. It was one benefit of spending so many years with Eleanor, Harper reasoned. Tabitha knew how to take a hit. Despite Harper's mortification, she had the wherewithal to take the crowd's temperature. The friends and neighbors assembled to mourn the passing of Billy Frost seemed aghast, not at Harper or Tabitha mistaken for Harper, but rather at Sadie Zimmer. The island girl, who had made such a success of her mother's pie business, was revealed to be a raging psychopath. She had slapped one of Billy Frost's daughters, the wrong daughter, as it turned out, the one who lived on Nantucket. As distressing as the matter had been 30 seconds earlier, now that Mrs. Zimmer had been restrained, people became titillated rather than alarmed. Billy's friend Smitty turned to Roger Dorr, who was standing next to him, and said,
This has to be the greatest story from any memorial reception ever.
Roger Dorr raised a glass.
Leave it to Billy, he said.
But it was Eleanor who had the final word. Oh, how Harper disliked her mother at times, yet she couldn't dispute the fact that Eleanor had the countenance of a queen, a regal bearing, an unassailable authority. She had been raised a Brahmin and remained one to her core. Eleanor approached Sadie and said,
I don't know who you are, but showing up at an event like this to air your personal grievances is nothing short of disgraceful. A man has died and deserves to be remembered fondly and cheerfully. So please, take your petty drama elsewhere.
Sadie's bulging eyes narrowed with this reprimand.
Your daughter is a tramp, she said. I don't care, Eleanor said. Please go.
Sadie allowed herself to be escorted from the tent by Reed and Drew. A waiter brought Tabitha an ice pack for her face. Some genius in the clubhouse found a way to pipe in music, and immediately Mozart restored civility to the proceedings. Harper, for a second believing she had survived the worst-case scenario unscathed, helped herself to another glass of champagne. The slap must have knocked Tabitha into a state of shock, but no sooner did she set her ice pack down on one of the high tops than she returned to her usual self. She glared at Harper.
What the hell was that?
Harper regarded her sister.
I liked you better when you were a pony, she said. Remember how I used to ride on your back?
Who was she, Harper? Harper debated. Lie or tell the truth? Eleanor and Ainsley were both waiting for an answer as well. Could Harper get away with saying she had no idea? Suddenly, they were approached by Kendall, the general manager of Farm Neck.
I'm sorry about that little scene with Mrs. Zimmer, he said. None of us had any idea she was so agitated. Dr. Zimmer is a member in good standing here. We had no reason to expect any trouble.
Of course not, Harper said. It's not your fault.
Is this your sister?
Kendall asked. He offered his hand to Tabitha.
So nice to meet you. Please accept my condolences about your father. The entire staff here at Farm Neck were big Billy Frost fans.
Tabitha gave Kendall a patient smile. My father was one of a kind.
He was a rapscallion, Eleanor murmured, an incorrigible hooligan.
Mother, Harper said. Then she remembered that Eleanor had always been a disaster when drinking champagne.
Well, anyway, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Tabitha said.
Kendall gave her a little geisha bow, and Harper thought maybe he was flirting with Tabitha. Would that be such a terrible match? Kendall, properly Kenneth Daw, was recently divorced from Penny Daw, who worked at the Duke's County Courthouse in Edgartown. Kendall was as handsome as his namesake, but so fastidious that many vineyarders thought Kendall and Penny had divorced because Kendall was gay. But he wasn't gay. He was merely particular about how he looked and presented himself, which was appropriate for the GM of an exclusive golf club. And it also made him a potential match for Tabitha. But no further words were exchanged. Kendall moved off to chat with Smitty, and Tabitha got her verbal machete out and held it to Harper's neck.
Mrs. Zimmer? Dr. Zimmer? Were you sleeping with Billy's doctor? His married doctor?
Harper said, I think you'd better go.
Yes, Eleanor said. For once, Pony, I agree with your sister.
At 6 o'clock that evening, when Harper pulls her Bronco up to her duplex and unloads the bakery boxes filled with leftover tea sandwiches, she understands that there will be backlash. Drew is sitting on her front step in street clothes, jeans, a blue chambray shirt, and navy espadrilles that he wears despite the ribbing he receives from the other officers and from Harper. He is also wearing the face of dejection.
You were sleeping with Dr. Zimmer?
He asks.
No,
Harper says automatically.
Dr. Zimmer is such a great guy. I love that guy. I look up to that guy. He's a hero of mine. He wanted to work with me on a drug awareness program in the middle school because he agreed with me that we have to reach kids while they're at their most impressionable.
Drew, Harper says,
She steps around him, opens her front door, and carries the bakery boxes to the kitchen, with Fish in hot pursuit. Fish has never met a bakery box he didn't like. Billy used to buy a dozen donuts and give a third of them to the dog. The white powdered sugar variety is his favorite. "These are sandwiches," Harper says. She tosses Fish one made from egg salad and watercress, which he devours, then a radish and butter sandwich, which he sniffs, then leaves on the floor.
"Yeah, I don't blame you."
Drew stays on the front porch.
"No," Harper thinks. "Whatever is going to transpire here will not happen in full view of the street."
"Come in, please," she says.
"I tried calling your cell phone," he says. "I called 17 times and left 11 messages because I want to know if what Mrs. Zimmer was accusing Dr. Zimmer of is true."
Harper's mind wanders, as it tends to do when she is hearing something unpleasant. She sings off key. "I saw her today at the reception, a glass of wine in her hand."
Drew says, "She said you were having an affair with Dr. Zimmer. She said she has proof."
Harper's insides freeze with fear.
"Proof?"
Harper pulls Drew by the arm back to the front door. There's no sign of a vehicle.
"How did you get here?" she asks.
"I had the chief drop me off."
"The chief?"
Harper says.
"Chief Oberg?"
Drew nods.
"When we started dating, he tried to warn me about you. He told me you used to be a coke dealer."
Harper shakes her head. "Not even close."
"But you did something wrong."
"If I had, Drew, the last person I would admit it to is you."
"I want you to confess that you were having an affair with Dr. Zimmer."
"No," Harper says. "There was a misunderstanding."
"That's crap."
"Please don't go around talking about what happened at my father's reception," Harper says. "People love to gossip on this island, Drew. Even good, well-meaning people like Chief Oberg."
"Why would Sadie Zimmer act that way if she didn't have proof?" Drew says. "You were having an affair with Dr. Zimmer. You've been lying to me, Harper. I thought we were exclusive. My aunties made lobster stew for you."
"Please," Harper says. "Please, Drew, do not talk about this to your family." She closes her eyes as she imagines Drew, four aunties, and his mother, Yvonne, Oak Bluff's all-time favorite selectman, gathered around the kitchen table with their coffee and their homemade cinnamon rolls, 1 minute thinking, "Isn't it nice that handsome child Drew found a woman he likes, even if she does live in Vineyard Haven?" The next minute learning that the woman is a cheat, sleeping with nice, kind Dr. Zimmer, who prescribes their blood pressure medicine. And as it turns out, the woman is not only a cheat, but also a former criminal, which escaped their previous notice because Joey Bowen only sold drugs to white people. Once the aunties and Yvonne get hold of the story, it will spread like a raging forest fire through the Methodist campground, through their church, through the town administration building, the public library, the hair salon, the steamship authority terminal, and finally to the lookout, where every local person Harper knows likes to go for a drink in the summer. The influence of the Snyder sisters knows no bounds.
"People are going to find out no matter who I tell or don't tell," Drew says. "I'm an officer of the law. I can't date a woman with a reputation like yours. We have to break up."
This pronouncement comes as an unexpected relief.
"Okay,"
Harper says.
"Okay," Drew says. "You're just going to let me go?"
"You don't trust me," Harper says. "You believe the talk. There's no hope for a relationship without trust, Drew."
"But," Drew says.
"I'm too old for you anyway," Harper says. "Find someone younger. Get married. Have a baby."
"I don't want a baby," Drew says. "I want you."
"Don't second guess yourself," Harper says. "You're doing the right thing."
"But I think I might be in love with you," Drew says.
"I'll call you a cab," Harper says.
She and Fish eat the rest of the tea sandwiches for dinner, and Harper throws back a six-pack of Amity Island Ale. The beer makes her brave, at least temporarily. She turns on her cell phone. She sees the 11 voicemails from Drew. There is also a voicemail from her boss, Rooster, and a voicemail from a local vineyard number that Harper suspects is Sadie Zimmer's cell phone. There are 7 text messages from Drew and a text from Reed. This last message is the only one she cares about. It says, "Sadie on a rampage, telling everyone about catching us at Lucy Vincent. I just got a call from Greeny. Please don't contact me for a while. I'm sorry." Harper squeezes her eyes shut. It's over with Drew. And now it's over with Reed. Greeny, Adam Greenfield, is the president of the hospital's board of directors. Unchartered horrors and humiliations lie ahead. How did Harper not understand this 3 days ago? Her phone rings and she thinks, Reed. He loves her. Of this she is certain. She felt it most keenly in the parking lot. It was more than sex. It was love. Would it be naive of Harper to believe that Reed might leave Sadie for Harper? Reed and Sadie don't have children. They don't even have a dog. So what reason would there be for Reed to stay? But when Harper checks her display, she sees that the person calling is Tabitha. Harper groans. Nothing from the woman in 14 years, and now she's blowing Harper up. What are the chances that Pony is calling to check on Harper, see how she's doing, ask if there is anything she can do to help? What are the chances that Tabitha is calling for any reason other than to thank Harper for mucking up her own life so badly that Tabitha became a victim? Zero chance, Harper decides. She lets the call go to voicemail.